Welcome back to the Ion College Basketball Podcast. I have Matt Norlander with me. We got a lot of stuff to get to, including Kentucky's 6-0 start in the SEC. Jimmy Patzos' hilarious handshake line from last night. My list of leading candidates for National Coach of the Year. And we'll have some predictions for tonight's biggest games, specifically Notre Dame at Florida State and Florida at South Carolina. But I wanted to start with what is the biggest news in college basketball from this week, undeniably, and that is Maurice Watson's torn ACL at Creighton. I think most of us were celebrating MLK Day on Monday, and a lot of us were watching college basketball in the afternoon, and Maurice Watson went down, non-contact, in what eventually became Creighton's victory at Xavier. And afterward, even though Mo Watson had reportedly told Greg McDermott, his coach, that he heard it pop and that he's, quote, done, Greg McDermott, I'm assuming, after talking with the medical staff, said publicly on Monday evening that the ligaments seemed fine, that there might be a meniscus problem, but that the ligaments, specifically the ACL, seemed okay. And yet, they got back to Omaha, had an MRI done yesterday afternoon, and we find out that that just was not the case. It's a torn ACL. It is a season-ending injury. It is a college career-ending injury. And it sucks, Matt, anytime any young person has to have their college career end in this way. But it is especially rough when your college career ends this way, when you are having the type of college season Mo was having, and you are a part of the type of team that Creighton has become, because this was a legitimate Final Four contender. He was a legitimate, you know, first-team All-American contender. And I don't want to end Creighton's season today. Like, we'll let him keep playing. But when you lose a player of this caliber, it almost certainly lowers the ceiling on what's possible for you. And it just, like, genuinely made me, like, sick to hear this news yesterday, because you know, like I've said many times, at Kentucky, Duke, North Carolina, the great years come along a little more often than they do at a place like Creighton. And when you get them, you just hope you can capitalize on them. When everything is fitting perfectly, you've got an All-American point guard, you've got a high-level veteran scorer on the wing in Marcus Foster, you got a one-and-done prospect in the front court, like, you know, in Justin Patton. Like, that's it doesn't come together like this often at a place like Creighton, or at most places, frankly. And for to have it ripped away like this, just really, really brutal.
You don't see, you know, Kenyon Martin was the example of a player in his final year, both in terms of seeding, how it will be affected, and how you have a guy's career end with injury, and that guy being, you know, a top 10 player in the sport. I don't know how often we get a potential first team All-American candidate in his final season of college eligibility go down with a career ending injury, essentially. Now, Watson will obviously hopefully be able to rehabilitate himself and will certainly have a good chance, I think, at having a solid career overseas. But this is, I mean, it's never going to be like it was. You're never going to have a year in your life where you're playing for a top 10 team. Creighton's off to its best start in program history. Watson's gone from mid-major recruit who played on the East Coast at BU to transferring to Creighton and turning his game into something that really was so well tailored to the offensive schematics of Greg McDermott's system. And, you know, we have mentioned before how Creighton's really been underrated, and I actually believe that with Watson they were a true title contender. You know, they might have had to get a few breaks go their way, but I thought with him leading the nation in assists, almost a full assist more than Lonzo Ball before he went down, and that kind of brought him from 8.8 to 8.5 per game, which is still the best in the country and might wind up as number one in the country at the end of the season.
Right.
But it is heartbreaking to see this, because he's not a sophomore, he's not a junior. This is his final year. He has passed the Rubicon, so to speak, for having a redshirt year. He's already played too many games to qualify to come back for another year, so he won't have that. And for Creighton, you know, they're really talented. They still have a lot. Listen, they've had plenty of guys that have had really good years, and most notably Marcus Foster, who's been a top 30 player. Justin Patton has established himself as a top 10 freshman of impact, and really, if you look at the stats he does and what he does all around, he's been really good. They've got, you know, Khyri Thomas is solid. Cole Huff, I think, is actually one of the more underrated players in the league. But the one area where they're soft is that Watson doesn't really have a viable backup. I think they're going to go by committee here. I don't know what the, and it'll be interesting to see what Creighton's offense then becomes with that. I think they'll still be good. And as for their selection committee, stance, here's what I expect. They will get credit for going 18-1. The committee isn't going to disregard that, but they now have a very solid sample size coming, a minimum of 13 games, because they have 12 regular season games to go, and they'll play at least one in the Big East tournament. So a minimum of 13, maybe a maximum of 15, and they will clearly be able to look at, here's what Creighton was with Watson, here's what Creighton is without. They won't disregard going 18-1, but the 19-game sample size will have less influence, I believe, on their seeding than the 13 to 15 game sample size that is to come. My expectation is this: if Creighton is able to keep it together here, so to speak, finish with, let's just say, 4 losses on the season, I would expect them to get a really, really good seed, because they would have proven, even against, some good competition, they've got plenty of road games remaining. If they only lose 3 more times, the Watson injury won't have too much of an impact. But if this team goes 500 down the stretch, then it wouldn't surprise me if you saw Creighton's record be drastically different from every other team on its seed line. Because if it went 500 down the stretch, you could make an argument that, okay, without Watson, this team might be, 7 or 8 seed quality then, and maybe that's where they wind up. So it'll be very interesting to follow. To me, they're now one of the most intriguing teams to track GP, just because he was so important. He's gone, and now the committee will look at that.
Kenyon Martin immediately came to mind. He, of course, broke his leg in what was the Great Midwest Conference tournament when Cincinnati, I think, was clearly the best team in the country that season. I talked to Bob Huggins about it a few weeks ago in advance of his 800th win. And I think the way I posed the question was, do you ever wonder, like, what would have happened if Kenyon didn't break his leg? He said, I don't have to wonder. I know what would have happened. We would have won the national championship. Like, he was not going to let us lose. And I believe that's the year Michigan State went and got the national championship. Isn't that right? 2000?
Yes.
So, like, think about this for a second. The only reason I most people, I don't want to say most people, I'll just speak for myself. The only reason I think Bob Huggins doesn't have a national championship right now is because Kenyon Martin broke his leg in the pyramid during the Great Midwest Conference tournament, a pyramid, by the way, in downtown Memphis that is now a Bass Pro Shop. The only reason Huggs doesn't have a national title is because of that. The only reason Tom Izzo does have a national title is because of that. And so I can't, I'm confident there are other examples, but I couldn't think of one off the top of my head of a true national title contender. And by the way, Creighton was that. You're exactly right. Not just because they were 18-1, but because, they check a lot of the boxes that you have to check to be on the list of true national title contenders. And if you want to scale it back a little bit and say true Final Four contender, that's fine with me. But they were so good offensively, and talented enough, old enough, they were capable of doing whatever it is you wanted them to do. I can't think of another outside of Kenyon Martin where, a national title contender lost its best player to a season-ending injury this late into the season. I know Duke lost Kyrie Irving for a little while, but then he came back. But the idea that you would lose a player of this importance from a team with these types of aspirations is pretty rare. And you touched on something that I think is 100% true. You never get this back, and you I don't think you ever get it out of your head. Like, I know Huggs said, I don't have to wonder. I know what would have happened. But for Maurice Watson, he would have to wonder. Who knows what would have happened? And I imagine that eats at you forever. Like, I bet you it's going to be 30 years from now, and Mo Watson's going to be sitting around with a couple of other guys he played college basketball with, and they will, over beers or wine or perhaps just soda, get into a conversation where they go, man, what would have, man, do you think we could have, man, what, like, because in the NBA, even if you are on, your way to what could be a great season, and your best player goes down with a knee injury, you can still, as long as he's under contract and all of that stuff, sort of look at him and look at each other and say, all right, you know, this is awful. This is unfortunate. But, like, we'll take another shot at it next year. But in college basketball, there is never a next year with similar circumstances as this year. You know, if you're a great team, you are almost certainly going to lose players either to graduation or to the NBA draft. But great teams don't return intact. And so we already know Creighton's not going to have Maurice Watson next season. His college career is done. Might not have Justin Patton next season. Could be a one-and-done guy. And so Creighton, at a place like Creighton, I don't want to say stumbled into this because that discredits what Greg and his staff have done. But it just sort of everything is broken perfectly. They get a transfer who emerges into one of the best point guards in America. Another transfer who, you know, looks a lot more like he was as a freshman at Kansas State as opposed to a sophomore at Kansas State. They get an off the radar front court prospect who redshirts and then start showing up in the top 20 of NBA mock drafts. Like, when does this type of stuff happen? And yet it was happening, and now it's just over, and it's just, ugh. I mean, I felt sick for obviously Mo more than anybody else because it's his knee, it's his career, it's his everything. But for that staff, for that program, and for those fans, they were living through something right now that they'd probably been dreaming about forever. And again, perhaps it goes on and finishes well, but it's probably not going to be what it was. We were in studio last night here in New York, CBS Sports Network. I was with Dana Jacobson, Wally Zerbiak, and Danny Granger. And Dana asked me, so how do they replace him? And I sort of thought about it for a half second and said, they don't. There's no sense in lying to each other. You know, whatever you thought was possible for Creighton yesterday or, 3 days ago is speaking frankly and candidly, it's just not possible anymore, is it?
No, it's not. And McNervin knows that, and they'll adjust accordingly. And this is still a tournament, without Watson, they're still tournament level good, and I think have the capability to win some games, but the expectation level totally gets dialed back. And, everyone outside of that locker room, I think, will realize that. And it's on McDermott, the staff, and the players to think, no, that we can still do this without Watson. And Watson will still be around the team. He's a real influential kind of guy. What I found interesting about this Creighton team is that in terms of its points per possession, Synergy had put out a stat. This team has been more efficient on offense and was on pace, at least, than the McDermott team, which was really, really good and had, obviously it had nights. I mean, it had that epic night. It, like, killed Villanova, both times it played that season. Right. So that team was really capable of just going on fire and flaming you. This team was on pace to have a better points per possession offense than the Creighton one per Synergy stats. And I thought that was pretty damn telling. And a lot of that, obviously, was Watson, who when you watch Creighton play, you could see clearly how much of the offense ran through him, and it was so fluid and solid, very good on-court leader. And, it's just a bummer. We'll see what happens for Creighton from here on out. It was impressive that they were able to get the win at Xavier on the road. He went down in the first half, and it was a close game. So after they lose their guy, they were still able to pull out what I think will be a good road win, and the committee will take note of the fact that he went down in the first half of that game and the team did win the game without him.
Yeah, I didn't know if that was a great thing for Xavier a great thing for Creighton or just a really bad thing for Xavier. I guess we'll find out over the rest of this regular season, but if Creighton loses its most important player in the first half and you're at home, like, you got to be able to knock that out. That was a tough spot for the Musketeers. Let me tell you about SeatGeek. Next time you're getting ready to buy tickets, that's what you're going to do. Go to SeatGeek.com or just download the SeatGeek app, because that is the company that has made it easier than ever to get the concert tickets that you want, to get the tickets to the games that you want, to the shows that you want. What they do is all the work for you. They handle price comparison by searching multiple ticket sites, and that way they're going to ensure that you get the best possible deal. Like I said, they do all the work. You save time and money, and the promo code is COLLEGEBB. That's COLLEGEBB, so use it when you're at SeatGeek, and you'll get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. So you got me? Listen up. Download the SeatGeek app, It's what I've done. It's what Matt Norlander's done. When you purchase tickets, and it doesn't matter to what, games, concerts, whatever, when you purchase tickets, use the promo code COLLEGEBB. That's COLLEGEBB, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Again, promo code COLLEGEBB. That's SeatGeek, millions of tickets in one place. Meantime, Kentucky improved to 6-0 in the SEC on Tuesday night. They won down at Mississippi State. Got up big early. Like, I think we're up around 18, 20 points. I mean, they were up big early. And then Ben Howland's team made a comeback. Got it close, but I don't think ever seriously threatened to win the game. But they did make it competitive and covered the 14.5 points for anybody who might have had a plus 14.5 points. How about this? I went and looked this up this morning. Kentucky 6-0 SEC, four of those wins have come by 20-plus points. They are 16-2 overall. 13 of those wins have come by 20-plus points. But more interestingly to me, they are 43-5. In their last 48 games against SEC opponents, 43-5. It obviously dates back to that perfect season in the league in, I guess it was 2014-15, where they went 18-0 in the regular season against SEC teams and then 3-0 in the SEC tournament. So that's 21 of the wins right there. But 43-5 in their last 48 games against SEC opponents. I just remember when John Calipari was at Memphis and Memphis was in Conference USA, and John was rolling through the opponents one after another, just stacking up blowout win after blowout win after blowout win, to the extent that anybody was critical. And most people weren't, because like those teams were going to Elite Eights. One played for the national championship. One was within a second of the national championship. But still, to the extent that there were some folks being critical or at least discounting it, they would say, yeah, that's fine, but let's see, you know, has he ever done it in a power league? Has he ever done it in a so-called real league? You know, what would he do if he had to play in a power conference? And I'm not going to sit here and pretend that the SEC is the ACC, but the SEC is by definition a power conference, and he's 43-5 in his last 48 games. Is this great for Kentucky, terrible for the SEC, or some combination of the two?
I think it's terrible for the SEC. Kentucky's going to be good pretty much every year with Calipari, with the exception of that Nerlens Noel injury year where they went to the NIT and lost at Robert Morris. That is the aberration. That is the exception that proves the rule. This is not good for the SEC. It's not good that Kentucky is lording over its conference to an even more dominant extent than Alabama has done in football. We have discussed many times, both in print and on the podcast over the past 3 years, why there were indications that the league should be getting better, and perhaps it still will, but that's borne no fruit so far, GP. It's a really bad look for the conference when Kentucky is able to so dominantly run through it. And I understand that Calipari is recruiting on a different level from everyone within the conference, but still, it's, even if you include that and put an emphasis on that, there's no one that's even at their table. Okay, it would be one thing if Kentucky won it every year, but won the league by a game, maybe occasionally by two games, got picked off here and there. But when you watch them play, there's just no one there. Like, it's becoming, I wrote this the other day, it's becoming like Gonzaga in many years in the WCC, and that's not the case this year, because I do think St. Mary's is closer to Gonzaga than anyone is in the SEC to Kentucky. And I know that Florida is good, but I don't think that Florida is just, I don't think Florida's in Kentucky's class this year. So now it becomes an issue. Like, you know, Kentucky's going to lose, I mean, max twice, probably not even that.
I don't
probably
think that. I think they'll lose one more game. And it might not even be a league game. Like, it might be the home game to Kansas.
Right. So
I think they'll either lose at Florida. I don't think they have to go to South Carolina, do they?
I don't think they do.
I don't believe they
play
go.
South Carolina at home this weekend.
Yeah, I don't think. Yeah, they don't go to South Carolina. So I could see them getting caught at, like, and it wouldn't be getting caught. I mean, like, you know, not like, you know, it's the old dome, for crying out loud.
It is the Odom. No, no one just walks into the no one just walks in the Odom expecting a win. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, so like it wouldn't even be getting caught. It'd just be like losing a you know, it's just like Villanova losing at Butler. You know, like sometimes that's you know, sometimes that's going to happen to you even if you're great. So I could see him losing at Florida. I could see
maybe
him
Georgia.
I could see him maybe losing at Georgia. I could see them you know, obviously if you're playing Kansas even inside Rupp Arena, like that's a real opponent, but however it shakes out, I don't think they lose more than one more game.
Yeah. So they're going to be a one seed. And even like last night, they're on the road, and Mississippi State's not that good. And I understand that it ended up as a single-digit margin. But like Malik Monk doesn't have a good game at all, and it's really not that close. De'Aaron Fox does his thing. He's their best and most important player.
True.
As long as he's doing that, they're going to be in good shape on the road against most teams. And Kentucky's just going to head toward a one seed. And because it's going to have that one seed validated, by the way. I don't want to hear that because the SEC is down, and I don't think we're going to hear too much of this, but I could see it happening where people cite the SEC's weakness as a reason why Kentucky shouldn't be a one seed if we get into a situation where we have five or six teams competing for one seed, which I, you know, I root for chaos. I'd like to see that. If they get to Selection Sunday with only three losses, I don't think there's going to be a case against them. Will be interesting to see. But yeah, this is not good for the SEC. It's too soon for me to say how many bids the league will get. It's going to get at least three.
Yeah.
But I mean, we shouldn't be having this conversation. Like the SEC on a year-by-year basis should be in contention at bare minimum for four bids, and it's not right now definitively.
South Carolina, it should be noted, is still undefeated with Sedarius Thornwell, and the committee, just like the committee is going to take into account what Creighton is without Maurice Watson, it will take into account what South Carolina is with Sedarius Thornwell, and what South Carolina is with Sedarius Thornwell is undefeated so far. So I know that, you know, last year it sort of fell apart for South Carolina and they ultimately got left on the wrong side of the bubble, but I don't believe that's going to happen this year. I'm with you. That league's going to get at least three, and then we'll see what happens after that, but it'll Kentucky, Florida, and South Carolina, I'll be shocked if if those three aren't in, and like, by shocked, I mean like it's not going to happen. Those three are going to get in. Meantime, while Kentucky was winning in Starkville, there was a game played between Siena and Ryder. And that is not something that if you'd asked me this time yesterday, would I have a bullet point in my notes to make sure we get to it on the Eye on College Basketball podcast. But here we are, and the reason is because there was an altercation between the teams, and it got a little ugly. And then after the game, you know, you do your normal handshake line, right? Coaches shake hands with players, whatever. And Jimmy Patsos, the Ryder coach, Jimmy Patsos, the Siena coach, rather, you know, he starts walking toward midcourt, and there's no team there. Kevin Baggett had pulled the Ryder team off the court, and they just all walked to the locker room and refused to shake hands, at which point, rather than just, you know, stop or turn around or do, you know, whatever, Patsos goes through the entire what would have been the handshake line, shaking fake imaginary hands one after another after another. And for people who don't know Jimmy, he is truly one of the great characters in,
yes,
in college basketball. Like, you know, when you do that thing where over the summer we said, hey, who would you like to, if there's any coach in college basketball you get a drink with, who is it? And Bob Huggins was the runaway winner. And that makes sense. And Bill Self, I believe, was second. And that also makes sense. But Patsos, like, he's on that list. At least he is.
He got votes.
Yeah.
He did get votes.
I've had drinks with Jimmy Patsos. I can vouch for it. He's fun. And so just a funny scene last night from a guy with a great sense of humor. And then even afterward, you know, when he had every opportunity to badmouth, you know, Ryder, badmouth Kevin, say that was cheap or Bush League or whatever, he just sort of took the high road and said, yeah, you know, whatever, I like Kevin, it's all good. And so he turned a weird moment into a hilarious moment and then took the high road. That's a good Tuesday night for Jimmy Patsos.
Talking Mac hoops and some Ryder Bronx right now. Patsos is incredible, and this is why I really like college basketball, because you've got an inventory of 351 teams and you're just going to get some different kind of dudes as head coaches. It's inevitable. I love it. Patsos is hilarious. He is on the short list with Greg Campy at Oakland as some of the funniest dudes in the sport. And it's the way, like, it's just his body language. Like, he's nodding his head, like, as he's like walking through, miming. And dude, it's too good. There are plenty of YouTube-worthy pathos moments. He is the coach, by the way. Hardcore College Hoops fans know that when he was at Loyola,
Right.
he was the one who threw that gimmick defense at Steph Curry, where he was triple teamed the entire game, even when he didn't have the ball and his team lost. But he was the one that was able to. Now, I don't remember Curry's line in that game,
It was terrible.
but
He didn't play. I mean, he didn't play well.
But he simply refused to let Curry beat him. He's like, I don't care, the rest of the team's gonna beat me, but I'm not gonna let this dude shoot. And I think a triple team. I don't think it was a double team. And if it was a double team, I know there were some triple teams, because I remember watching the video and it's Curry literally camped out in a corner with three dudes on him, while the rest of the team's like running offense. So weird. And I remember Patsos got criticized for that, but hey.
I criticized him for it. I felt bad about it later. Although I did,
Well, no, but there's legitimate criticism for it, because in a way it was gimmicky, but it did get us talking about his program. It got him talking about the league. Now, it was in a loss, but that was kind of his moment of national arrival.
It really was. It was his first. Like, I don't know that I ever knew. I certainly didn't know Jimmy before that. But I like, was I even. I guess I probably was, but like, was I even aware of Jimmy Patsos before that moment? Like, I don't know.
Right. Yeah. No. Listen. Funny moment. Good moment. Like, these things kind of sprinkled throughout the season, and occasionally tempers flare up. That could have been a potentially ugly situation, and Patsos, and it looked like he was trying to calm it down. And Baggett was super heated. We had two, Kentucky, Mississippi State almost had
Right.
a thing, and then this happened as well. College basketball doesn't need brawls. It brings media attention, but that's something obviously that the sport doesn't necessarily need. So from that, a good, funny, lighthearted moment from Patsos afterward. And I'm all for that, man. I'm all for coaches showing personality and being different. It's what kind of makes college hoops so fun.
I put together a list yesterday afternoon of the top National Coach of the Year candidates. Who would you have number one right now?
Right now, I wasn't ready for you to ask that question. I think it would still be Drew, I think, right now. As of like us recording this podcast, I think I would still have Drew.
I had Scott Drew number one, and that's because at the time they were 16-1. Obviously, they won last night, beat Texas. And how about this? There's a million different ways you can frame how impressive it is that Scott Drew, what Scott Drew's done. Here's yet another way. Baylor beat Texas, like beat them convincingly. Like doesn't even register. Like think
Yeah.
about like it's just
True.
like it's like whatever. Like the idea. That once upon a time that Baylor could just beat Texas and it wouldn't even register. Like it'd be like, of course Baylor beat Texas. Why wouldn't Baylor beat Texas? Is a testament to how far that program's come. It's also a testament to how bad Texas is this season. But let's focus on the other side. Baylor's 17-1 now, sixth in the AP poll. Only loss was that loss at West Virginia, and Scott Drew's doing this without any top 50 national recruits. Without any obvious future NBA players. He's got wins over Louisville, Oregon, and Iowa State on the way to the NCAA tournament for the fifth time in 6 years. We've probably spent more minutes on the podcast than we should talking about what's happened at Baylor this year and the job that Scott's done. But you and I are in agreement. If we had to name a National Coach of the Year right now, it would probably have to be, not have to be, but should be, Scott Drew. After that, I went Jay Wright second. And I know that he's got a good team, but like just because you're supposed to have a good team doesn't mean you should be penalized when it comes to college, Coach of the Year awards. Jay lost his captain, center, and top recruit and is still sitting here with an 18-1 record, lone loss at Butler. And they're ranked number one in the AP poll. I've got them ranked number one in the top 25 and one. Like, he's done a fabulous job, and they look like, legitimate contenders to win back-to-back national championships. Third, I had Steve Alford. I think that speaks for itself. He was 15-17 last year, signed a recruiting class that has turned and used this recruiting class to play a style that has allowed UCLA to start 18-1. I had some people on Twitter say, don't give Steve Alford the coach of the year. Give it to Lonzo Ball. And I hear you. But, the coaches are responsible for the players. And you know, it's not a given that any coach would be able to do what Steve is doing with this UCLA team. Like, every coach wouldn't turn them loose the way he's turned them loose. You know, Bryce is flourishing off the ball in a way that I don't think most people anticipated. TJ Leaf is, I think, now a top 10 national player of the year candidate, you know, with a very good opportunity to have a better freshman season than this freshman season Kevin Love had. So I think Alfred in the top three makes some sense. Bill Self, fourth. I think that speaks for itself. Kansas has won 17 straight games and is maybe on its way to its 13th straight Big 12 title. I had Mike Bray, 5. Chris Holtman at Butler, 6. Greg McDermott at Creighton, 7. Mark Few at Gonzaga, 8. Bob Huggins at West Virginia, 9. And Sean Miller at Arizona, 10. Our buddy Jeff Eisenberg said, he tweeted late last night from Yahoo Sports, that his top 10 would look a lot like that, but he would have Sean Miller higher. And I got no issue with somebody putting Sean Miller higher. The idea that Arizona's sitting here at 16-2, despite losing Terrence Ferguson in the offseason, Ray Smith in the preseason, hasn't had Alonzo Trier at all, lost its point guard for a handful of games, and still sitting here 16-2. Like, that's like three possible starters. Like, if you'd have talked to Sean in June and said, you know, Ray Smith, Terrence Ferguson, Alonzo Trier, he might have said, yeah, all three of those could start for me. And yet, and certainly what all three was going to be, they were all three going to be heavy, you know, like Ferguson and Trier might have been the best two players. While recognizing what Markin is doing, maybe not, but either way, to lose all of that, you know, before the season even begins, and still be sitting here like this on January 18th is incredibly impressive.
Yeah, a couple quick thoughts. One, the SEC being down is what will prevent John Calipari from winning Coach of the Year, because people look at competition level, other coaches they're going up against, look at their record, and it's just not going to help Calipari in this kind of year. This is how the SEC can hurt him. Leonard Hamilton's the only one. Now, we got Notre Dame at Florida State here tonight. So Leonard Hamilton's, I think, the only one not in your top 10 that would have a case. I would have Miller higher.
I have Leonard in the next 15 because I felt like once I got
what
to 10.
What is with that, by the way, listing 15 more?
You know what I learned a long time ago?
That's some CYA BS right there. Get out of here with this listing 15. You have more dudes listed off the list than you have on the list. That is crap, GP.
Here's what I learned a while ago. If the more names you include, the fewer times people ask you on Twitter, what about this guy? Why don't you hate this? Why do you hate this guy? It always gets turned into, like, why do you hate somebody? Like, I swear to God, the other day I wrote something. I don't even remember what it was about. And, like, somebody was accusing me of hating Villanova. And I'm like, you realize I'm the guy that wrote the Villanova column a couple of weeks ago about how they just had the most amazing 2016 calendar year in, like, the history of college basketball. But, like, fans have such a short memory, man. And it's like, it doesn't matter what you do with anything. It's like, you must hate this. So, yeah, I go, you know what? I just don't even want to deal with that. So I'll put every base, and you still get it. I got it, like, where's Josh Pastner? Which is a reasonable question, I guess. Although I will say the common thread between all 25 names that I listed is that they all basically got top 50 KenPom teams. And while Georgia Tech has overachieved, like, they're sitting here with 3 ACC wins, it's still not a top 50 KenPom team. It's not a team headed to the NCAA tournament. And so I didn't feel too awful leaving Josh off, although Josh is doing a great job in Atlanta. Eric Musselman, like, maybe should be on the list.
You got 25 names. Make 10, cut it off, have some freaking guts.
I'm trying to explain to you how to. I'm the master.
Yeah, I know what you're doing. Forget that. Like, okay, whatever, man. Just make the list.
You cut down on pointless questions for fans. Also, the retweets go through the roof. You got 25 different basketball programs retweeting Coach of the Year stuff.
I see.
I'm playing the game, Norlander. I'm playing
Mark Few is a lock to win this award if Gonzaga goes undefeated. If he has one loss, he'll probably win it. Probably two, then it gets really interesting. That's my other takeaway here. Right now, he's rightfully, I think, you know, 6-7 on your list. Gonzaga runs the table. It's going to be his in a runaway, though.
So we mentioned that there are two really good games tonight, top 25 matchups. One of them is a Florida State hosting Notre Dame. And this is a Notre Dame team that is one of the neat stories in college basketball. I didn't think they were going to be this good. I think at this point you have to assume that any Mike Bray team is going to be good because they usually are. But I think I got them, like, top 10 and in the top 25 and 1 right now. And I recognize that might be a little high. It is high relative to the computer numbers. But 16-2 only losses are to Villanova, Purdue, and 5-0 and alone in first place in the ACC. What do you want me to do with them? How do I keep them out of the top 10?
Not only that, but 5-0 in the ACC, and more games have come away from home than in South Bend, which is impressive. I don't care what the competition is, and the competition has been pretty decent. Unless Notre Dame gets just absolutely steamrolled here, I'm not going to think any less of them if they lose at Florida State tonight, because both 16-2 teams, Florida State's got the home game. Florida State's really good this year. I'll have a piece up on Notre Dame before Wednesday's done. Talk with Mike Bray, and we talked about a whole bunch of facets with his team and what he's done, and you know, he has this motto that he just repeats ad nauseum, but it works. You know, get old and stay old. You always have dudes that'll start as juniors and seniors on your team, and it will, you know, pretty much ensure that you will be successful. And that has certainly worked for him. He's going to make his seventh tournament in 8 years this year. What he noted to me was that, from his perspective, and I don't have the exact statistics to bear this out because it's granular, but he said his team in the final 4 minutes after the final under four timeout, this is the best defensive team he thinks he's ever had under 4 minutes to go. They are composed. They lock up. They get kills. So they track kills. So they have, if you get three straight possessions where they don't score, that's a kill, and they track those. And in every game that they've won close down the stretch, they've had at least one kill, and in many instances, two or three kills, specifically with that Pittsburgh game. So the fact that they've got that Matt Farrell has been so good. He gave me a great anecdote. So when Farrell had started with the program and was a freshman, and Pat Connaughton and Jaron Grant were on the team, you know, they run practice with you know, blue and white or blue and gold or whatever it would be, but Farrell would be on, you know, the second team, so to speak, and they would run end of game situations because he always runs them. And this is also why Notre Dame's been so good a lot of the time over the past 4 or 5 years, is because Bray puts an emphasis on different end game situations and scenarios and has his team run through them. And what he said was, and this was when Grant was a senior, Connaughton was a senior that year, he said Matt Farrell, this dude from Jersey no one knew, was killing them every single time of practice. And you occasionally get a story like this from a coach where it's just like, yeah, this guy, you see, this guy is good now. 2 years ago when no one was watching, he was effing our guys up, and I knew he was going to be good. That's basically what Farrell did, so much to the point where Farrell's second team kept beating Grant, Zach August, Connaughton every single time, that he stopped doing those drills for a week because he didn't want Grant and Connaughton's confidence to be totally killed off by this freshman dude they didn't even know coming in and kicking their ass. And so now you're seeing Farrell lead this team in such a great way at point guard. He's really been a top 10 point guard of impact. Vastorius hit big shot after big shot. You know, VJ Beachum's an NBA prospect. Bonzi Colson, to me, has been a top 25 candidate from the season start till now for player of the year. I mean, he will have a good chance of being, you know, first, second, third team All-American.
I have him now in the updated player of the year rankings. I've got him in the top 10.
Yeah, it's totally validated. So they've got a lot of really good guys at this point. And even if they lose at Florida State, Notre Dame is certainly a team to be taken seriously. And we're going to have our updated, Final Four picks, Player of the Year, midseason stuff on CBSSports.com this week. I just had a fun, they asked for a Final Four. And instead of doing, you know, the top four teams, which is, you know, totally, you know, within reason, my wild card pick, so to speak, the crazy wild card pick is actually Notre Dame, which ranks in top 10 at KenPom right now, top 10 in the polls. They've got the ability to do it. Second best offense in the country right now. And as Bray said, you know, their end of game defense has a lot of poise to it. And team is legit. They're just so much better than I thought they would be. I don't know if I'll ever make this mistake with Bray's Notre Dame teams again. I legitimately did not think they would be anything close to this. And they are on the reel.
Florida State is a 5.5 point favorite over the Irish. What are you doing? You taking points, you laying points?
I'm gonna take those points. I think I'll take Florida State to win, but I'm feeling like this could be a pretty damn good one. Notre Dame has a tendency to play really entertaining games, and I think we'll get that tonight.
I think Florida State wins, but I'll buy it up to plus six at -120, and take the Notre Dame to cover, but Florida State to win. The other interesting game, top 25 matchup, is South Carolina hosting Florida. As John Rothstein, a friend, pointed out on Twitter earlier today, stay hungry and humble. But also,
Obviously.
But also, it's good for the SEC to have a marquee game that doesn't have to rely on Kentucky to bring an audience. And I think that's a fair point. Like, when's the last time? How often does it happen where you've got a really compelling SEC game and it doesn't involve John Calipari's Wildcats? So that's good for the league. South Carolina, 1.5-point favorite tonight, and probably one of the biggest games to be played in Columbia since January 27, 2010, when Devin Downey got 30 points on the Kentucky Wildcats, outplayed John Wall, and handed John Calipari his first ever loss at Kentucky. Shout out to Devin Downey.
Hey, listen, did you catch my shout out to Devin Downey in text form on my Gonzaga undefeated thing? I worked it in because I did a chart of every last undefeated team over the
past
25 years. And so I put an asterisk next to South Carolina or Kentucky. And then I said, the asterisk denotes a shout-out to Devin Downey. So I'm going next level here.
We're coming up on the seven-year anniversary of January 27, 2010, Devin Downey's 30-point game against John Wall. It's a Friday.
So we're going to do a podcast on the seven-year anniversary.
We might just revisit the whole – we might dedicate the entire podcast to that game.
You know what I think we should do? I think we should actually start or finish the podcast with the audio call of that South Carolina Just pull it from YouTube and put it on there without a doubt. South Carolina, I think, is going to win this game by like 8 or 9 points. I think they've got Thornwell. They got the home floor. It's close between them and Florida as the SEC's best team. You have to think South Carolina is better just because it's yet to lose without Thornwell. And P.J. Dozier's been really good. I actually thought he would be a better freshman than he turned out being, but he's been a nice second-year player overall. They're both undefeated in league play, so it's good for the SEC in that regard. But I do think, you know, I'll go back to what I said earlier. I do think that these two teams, even though this will be a good game for the SEC, I don't expect many people to watch this and figure that the winner will be someone that's going to challenge Kentucky. I just don't find that to be the case. But it would be good for the SEC if this was a good and interesting game. It would not be good if South Carolina wins this game 63-50. You would want something compelling, and hopefully we'll get it. We'll see.
Hard to pick against South Carolina at home, particularly with Thornwell in the lineup. I've been ride or die with Florida, though. I dedicated a poll text column to them a couple weeks ago. So in the spirit of that, I will take the Gators to win in a really close game. But obviously, I'm aware that South Carolina is at home and the favorite. I'll just go wrong team favorite here and pick Michael White's team to remain undefeated in the SEC, although to be clear, I'm only doing that in the spirit of making a Politex column from 2 weeks ago look good. I don't even know that I actually believe it. Remember, you can subscribe to the Island College Basketball Podcast on iTunes. That's the best way to get the latest episodes as quickly as possible. So please do that. Thank you all so much for listening, and we will talk to you again on Friday morning. Till then, take care.